This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks with Michelle Owen, Alex Crook and Sam Matterface.
Hello and welcome to the latest All Football Commentators Are Geeks podcast.
I'm Sam Matterface from TalkSport and ITV.
I'm Alex Crook from TalkSport, a national newspaper journalist.
And I'm Michelle Owen from Sky Sports and Soccer Saturday. Well, that's if Jeff's not fired me.
Michelle Owen making a farewell appearance on Soccer Saturday.
I can't wait to hear how you dealt with that. Also this week, how Scott Parker got new friends, how I knew Poch had lost his rag, and we are joined by our TalkSport colleague, Jim Proudfoot, who shares his own story of England World Cup woe.
It could happen, but, you know, I may never commentate on a World Cup final again, let alone one that England are in. You can't take anything for granted. So there were definite tears in the eyes, and walking away from the stadium, knowing we'd be making the same walk 3 days later for a game that England weren't in, yeah, of course it was emotional because everyone's got so much invested in it.
Plus, I'll tell you which Premier League manager demanded I sat in a lucky seat and how I fell in love with Pep Guardiola after our first post-match encounter.
All on the podcast that encroaches on other people's territory, like Jan Vertonghen at a penalty kick. It's All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Some people are on the pitch, they think it's all over.
The only people you know that can legitimately buy a pair of binoculars. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
And don't forget, you can download any previous podcast you may have missed via the website. It's afcgeeks.com.
Okay, a big hello to all of you and to Crook, who is in a canteen somewhere in London. Is that correct?
I'm actually in a Holiday Inn reception that doubles up as the kitchen area. So big thanks to them because they let me jump on their Wi-Fi for a while.
Okay, that's good. So I take it you're waiting for a big exclusive interview, which we'll probably hear about in the next couple of days. Is that what you're stalking someone or staking someone out? What are you doing?
Something like that.
Okay.
Someone out? Sounds quite
you know,
gruesome.
On a stakeout, like, you know, you're watching someone do something dodgy and you're going to approach them and break a big story, you know, like a cop in a 70s TV show. Something you might have to do very soon, Michelle, because you might be out of a job. because we need the skinny on the bobble hat, Barney, and the bravery. What were you thinking when you decided to say this?
Jeff, you're jealous of Bobbly the Hat. I know you are. You want it on your hairline to cover up what you've got left. But Bobbly the Hat is in the car. Barney's at home. I'm watching the game. I'm concentrating. And Matt Grimes had a fantastic effort for Swansea on his left foot, shifted it, edge of the box, and forced Remy Matthews into a brilliant diving save. It's all Swansea so far. Dan James is trying to get at the defence, probably the quickest player, arguably, in the Championship. And he's already putting Bolton on the back foot. Swansea dominating, but still goalless.
Michelle Owen making a farewell appearance on Soccer.
Now, he's done you like a kipper there, which was brilliant, to be fair to him. But you started it. Why?
So, for context, this is the thing. It's obviously gone viral. And people have found it funny without knowing the full context. Earlier in the programme, there was a piece of myself with Leon Britton and Barney, my dog, and we went and did a piece down Swansea Bay last week. It was so windy, I had to put a hat on. The only hat I had in my car was like this pink one I used for walking Barney. I put it on, and maybe it's a little bit garish. Anyway, Jeff,
it's quite big as well, isn't it? It stands out, let's just put it that way.
It's very bright. I think that was the issue. And I saw Jeff on Friday and he's like, oh, have you got Barney on the program? I said, yeah. He said, oh, I have to think of a good line about that. And I thought, well, it probably just say something about Barney. I wasn't expecting it to be about the fashion. So I just, off the top of my head, that's what I came up with. But you're right, he completely,
so he'd criticized
as always,
you first, had he?
Yeah, earlier in the programme.
It was a good cane, to be fair. Great thinking off the top of your head.
Yeah, and good thinking off the top of Jeff's receding head as well afterwards to come up with that line. Can I just ask you whether or not you knew straight away that it'd gone viral? Because you don't, I take it you don't use your phone on the gantry.
Yeah, no, I don't check my phone till half time. And then I went on my phone and the Soccer Saturday account had obviously tagged me in it. So I saw it straight away. I'm like, oh, why have I got all these notifications? And I was like, oh. it went viral and I think a few people enjoyed it. But, you know, that's the point of difference about Soccer Saturday. We just have a bit of fun. We've had a few things before. We've had sloth jokes and dog jokes and now we're on to receding hairlines.
Yeah. Good. Okay, fair enough. Okay, so much to discuss on the show today and lots to get through.
Yeah, we covered the North London derby, the league leaders and Brendan Rodgers' first game between us this week. Let's try and make some sense of it all in the weekend in numbers.
The Geek Sheet. This week in numbers.
Manchester City are back on top of the table after their 1-0 win at Bournemouth. The 20th time the leadership of the Premier League has changed hands this season.
Yeah, that's incredible. I was at the Vitality Stadium. Bournemouth out to register a single shot on or off target. The first time since Opta started recording such records that has ever happened to a home team in the Premier League.
Romelu Lukaku's back-to-back braces against Southampton and Crystal Palace have provided Manchester United with a timely boost, but against their top six rivals, he has managed just one goal since the start of last season. Harry Kane has eight in that time.
Wow. Jurgen Klopp blames the wind for blowing Liverpool's title dreams off course. As they drew 0-0 at Everton, the Reds have dropped 11 of the last 27 points available after dropping only 6 of the first 60.
Gonzalo Higuain scored his third goal for Chelsea at Fulham this weekend, meaning it's their first away league goal of 2019. Only Huddersfield have not scored one since the start of the new year in the entire Football League.
And it was the tale of two penalties in the North London derby. One scored by Harry Kane, one saved by Hugo Lloris. No fixture in the Premier League has produced more spot kicks than the 18 in this matchup.
Is that a Hoover in the background?
Yeah, the cleaners just turned up.
That's great news. Right, should we start with the North London derby here? Because it was Maurizio Pochettino's birthday at the weekend, 47. Boy, does he look good for 47.
He does, yeah.
He wasn't as jovial as he appeared when we first exchanged pleasantries. He's always very smiley, is Maurizio Pochettino. But that wasn't the case at half-time. Poch got angry. Not with me, but his players. Now, despite saying afterwards when I was talking to him that he was happy with the performance, I knew he wasn't. I'd seen him at half-time rip off his navy jacket and storm down the tunnel, as I think we all had on TV. So I said to him, you know, you say you were happy with the performance, but you weren't really, were you? At half-time, you were quite frustrated. You stormed off down the tunnel before the game had come to its first half conclusion, and you took your jacket off as you went down the touchline. I mean, it was sort of gave Tim Sherwood's gilet a run for its money. He waited, looked at me, and he thought, yeah, do you know what? Actually, I wasn't happy at all. And then he went into a rant about how naive the defending was for the first goal, and he was quite cross about it. And subsequently, speaking to Danny Rose, he then admitted that actually Poch bellowed at them in the dressing room at half-time, something he doesn't usually do. But he said to them, I want you to go to war in this second half. And, you know, that's pretty much what they tried to do. They didn't create very much, though. I think they were really, really poor. And I think they've got a real issue with creativity. They've won 73% of the games that Dele Alli has started and won only 11 of the 21 that he's not started. They can't get him back quick enough. I think they've got a real issue with that.
Sorry, I'm a bit distracted because this is one of the best Hoovers I've ever seen. It's like a backpack on the back of the cleaner's back and she's, you know, just using it freely. You know when you're sat in the stands at American football or baseball, they come around with beer on their back. It's just like that.
Yeah.
Not quite as fun. No, listen, with Tottenham, I would be worried if I was a Spurs fan, and I'm going to tell you why. If you look at Pochettino's time in England, there is a pattern of his teams falling away at the end of the season. I've got some stats to back that up. At Southampton, in his only full season in charge, they won 4 of their final 13 matches. The season before, when he came in halfway through, they didn't win any of their last 6 games. In his first season at Spurs, they only managed to get all 3 points in 4 of their final 10 games. In 15-16, they didn't win any of their last 4. They lost 5-1, you may remember, at already relegated Newcastle on the last day. 16-17 was okay. And then last season, 3 wins in their last 7 matches. Now, is that down to working the players too hard? We know his training sessions, particularly in pre-season, are very intense. Maybe that catches up with him. Or simply, can he not handle the pressure at the business end of the season? I don't know the exact answer to that, but either way, I think those stats show it's very good news for Manchester United, for Arsenal, and for your club, Chelsea, Sam.
I just think they haven't got a big enough squad, and I think that's
borne out by the investment,
the amount of money that they spend on players, less than everybody else in the top six. And the players that they have got in the squad that are just outside that first 11, 12, 13 or 14 aren't as good as the ones that are in the first 11. You know, Llorente coming off the bench is not a great alternative for Harry Kane.
Yeah, I agree with Sam. They haven't got the squad depth. I think it's a little bit harsh on Pochettino because I can see what you're saying, Sam. There is a bit of a crook. There is a bit of a pattern. But like you said, last season wasn't so bad in terms of how they finished. And it's funny, isn't it, that he was being touted for the Manchester United job a couple of months ago, but now perhaps he's not flavour of the month. Oh, crook, have you been eaten by the Hoover?
No, I just turned him down because the Hoover was getting on my nerves. And I can imagine if you're listening at home, it's getting on your nerves as well. So while he's not talking, I'm just going to take him out for a bit. I was just going to point out that I think he's got a good point, though, when he says that are they working them too hard? Because his methods are quite intense. And if you do work players incredibly hard, you're going to get more injuries, as Jurgen Klopp found the first season that he was in the Premier League. But what you have to then do is adjust the squad size, which Liverpool have done, and why they found themselves in the position that they're in, and Tottenham haven't done, which is why they found themselves now floundering a little bit and struggling to get to the top four.
Yeah.
I do think that they will get past Borussia Dortmund and go into the quarterfinals of the Champions League. And I hope that they don't throw the top four away, because if they do, wow. Just on VAR, I was also in the tunnel with Unai Emery, because the Arsenal manager knew that his team should have won that game. The penalty right at the end was so very poor. And it was all down to pressure, because Aubameyang apparently loves to inquire about Harry Kane's goals. He wants to beat him. He wants to make sure that he finishes top scorer. Also, it could have been a goal that changed the whole season if he'd scored. But anyway, he missed it. It was terrible. And one thing Emery was certain about was he wants VAR and he wants it straight away, because the Kane penalty at one end would have been ruled out for offside because the offence took place before the foul. It's a bit complicated because if someone else had actually been fouled, it wouldn't have been ruled out. But because Kane was offside at the free kick and whilst challenging for that free kick, he was fouled, it should have been overturned. A free kick should have been given for offside instead. That would have been cleared up very, very quickly. At the other end, when Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang has his penalty saved, encroachment by Vertonghen, as you mentioned in the intro, and others ahead of the penalty meant it should have been taken again. The law states that if a member of the goalkeeper's team encroaches, if the ball does not enter the goal, the kick is retaken. So it should have been.
Is that a link back to the Hoover in the hotel?
I thought you'd been sucked up by the Hoover, to be honest with you.
If that you were hopeful.
Quite a powerful one.
Language of love. Our favourite words in the football lexicon.
Okay, this week the etymology of the phrase to go route one is the star of our Language of Love series. The old Wimbledon were famed for it. A few others in the Premier League era have been labelled route one teams. But why do you think we call it route one, Michelle?
Because when you look at a map and it's the most direct way, that's route one.
Okay, Crookie in the Cleaners Conference.
I'm just wondering if it's got something to do with transport, Route 1, bus route, train, possibly. Clutching at straws, maybe.
It's none of those, and I'll answer it for you very shortly. Can I just ask, is this what you really do when you're not working? You just go to hotels and clean them and you're on a break? Is that right?
Well, the wages talk sport pay. I've got to top up somewhere, haven't I?
Okay, well, we will answer that before the end of the show. Next, Pep turns on the charm, Crook's lucky chair, and coming up, we learn more about commentator Jim Proudfoot. What a
headshot! It's time for Tales from the Tunnel.
Most of us spend our Saturday afternoons hanging out in tunnels. Crook sounds like he's in a tunnel. He's not. He's being harassed by a cleaner in a Holiday Inn Express. But where were you Saturday?
She's getting closer. I was at Bournemouth on Saturday for arguably the most one-sided 1-0 victory in football history. City dominated possession. Bournemouth didn't have a shot, as we mentioned. But I've got to say, I thought City were great afterwards. Usually, players from the bigger clubs, the top six clubs, if you like, skip the mix zones. That's the area where the Monday newspapers hang out to get their quotes. But I saw Raheem Sterling go through there. Kevin De Bruyne stopped for a chat, even though he'd gone off injured in the game. Vincent Kompany, Ilkay Gundogan. So full marks to them. I thought that was fantastic. It was also the first time that I've had the chance to grill Pep Guardiola face-to-face. I've been involved in his press conferences before, but never part of the radio huddle for one reason or another. I didn't really know what to expect because, Sam, I know in the past you've had some negative experiences. I sounded out the Manchester City press officer beforehand. I asked what Pep was like with radio interviews. He assured me he'd be fine. I have to say, I thought he was charming, witty, generous with his time. Not sure about the grey jumper, but he was great.
He would be
I'm
great.
I'm wearing
though,
a grey jumper.
He would be great. He won, and he went top of the league, and they turned a 7-point deficit into a 1-point lead in 2 months. So he's going to be very happy. He wasn't so charming after they lost 4-1 at Leicester City 2 seasons ago, but that's a different matter. He always does speak. He just sometimes can come across a little bit prickly. I wouldn't say I was negative about him. I'd say I just thought, yeah, sometimes I thought it could be a little bit more. He just comes across disingenuous occasionally. Two things you shouldn't question, though. City as a club are absolutely brilliant with the media. And Pep is a style guru. With all due respect, I'm not being out of order, Crook, but he's certainly not going to be taking any advice from someone whose idea of top clobber is to pick up something from the French designer Matt Alain.
That I'm wearing is a grey jumper.
Outrageous. Yeah, I didn't warm to it. I thought it was a bit daggy. But listen, as you say,
a bit what?
Daggy. What? I thought he was a bit daggy.
Daggy.
What does that even mean?
A bit
what's
mumsy.
Wrong with a grey jumper?
You know, a bit mumsy.
Are you saying I'm a bit mumsy for wearing a grey jumper today?
I am, yeah. Yeah, it's something you've not told us.
Wow. This is all very rude.
He did give us a good line as well, actually. He said it was one of City's best ever wins. That's a direct quote. I think that was a touch dramatic, but to give us a nice soundbite. But you know what? Those 6 or 7 minutes in his company convinced me that City will retain the title. He was calm, he was measured, he had this air of confidence that Jurgen Klopp isn't really portraying at the moment with that stupid comment he made about the wind at the weekend. I spoke to Riyad Mahrez as well. He told me City are loving the pressure, which, let's be honest, Liverpool certainly aren't at the moment.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a long way to go yet. Don't get too excited about it. I know it's your dream to ensure that Manchester City get there ahead of Liverpool, but I'm not sure it'll go that way just yet. I backed Manchester City at the beginning of the season because I just thought they've got experience over course and distance. They've got a much bigger and probably better squad, but Liverpool have fought really well. And I tell you one thing, I think that people probably don't necessarily realise that this is a rarefied Premier League. The Tottenham are having their best ever season and they're in third position. Liverpool are having their best ever season even when they were winning leagues and they're in second. And Manchester City are, well, as you mentioned already, Pep said they're playing better than they did last year when they got 100 points. So I think the quality in the Premier League and the consistency amongst those top teams has been superb. I don't know what that says about the bottom of the Premier League, though.
There's like three leagues now, aren't there? There's the top sort of six. Then there's Leicester, Wolves, Everton, Watford. Who have I missed?
West Ham, maybe.
There's like a cluster. West Ham as well. So there's that cluster of teams there. Yeah, I said Wolves. And then under that, all those teams are trying to stay up. So.
Oh, you are kidding me.
Oh, my goodness.
You are kidding me. Where are you? You're in the air raid shelter or something now.
I've been assured this is just a drill. So.
Oh, great.
Oh, my word.
This is going to be the worst podcast we've done.
There you go. Don't worry. The alarm bells aren't sounding here like they are for Jurgen Klopp.
So you were in love with Poch. You didn't like Klopp. Now you're not so keen on Poch. Still not a fan of Klopp, but love Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, Pep, and trying not to wreck it, Ralph. You are very free with your love, aren't you?
I'm nothing if not fickle. I would say that. Yeah, you mentioned not to wreck it, Ralph. This is funny, actually. So a couple of weeks ago, I asked Ralph Hasenhüttl a question. He said he'd been asked it before. I said, yeah, probably by me. And then he made a little quip about me always sitting in the same dark corner of the press conference. The next week, before Southampton played Fulham, I swapped sides the room, which he found hilarious. He literally walked into the room, spotted me, burst out laughing. He was still giggling when Sky kicked off the press conference. Now, of course, they beat Fulham. So I went there on Friday and I reverted back to my old seat. He spotted that and he asked me to move. Because, of course, they've won with me sitting on the other side of the room.
Well, see, the comedy shows must be cracking in Austria.
I was in two minds, to be fair, because obviously I wanted United to win. But I did it anyway. And then when United went 1-0 down and when Southampton got back to 2-2, I was cursing myself, saying, what did you do that for? But it worked out OK for them in the end because, obviously, United won. But it was OK for Southampton as well because his team played really well. Should give them the confidence now they need for the rest of the season. I guess I'm going to be sat on the light side of the room for the foreseeable future.
I wonder how many superstitions you've got, Michelle, because Crook actually takes this seriously. He would have believed when Manchester United were losing to Southampton, it was all down to where he sat. Like he will wear the same shirt, or he's got this thing about make. You've done things like change shirts at half time, change pants at half time, or move position, haven't you? Just because you think it influences the outcome of the game, which it doesn't.
I do sometimes. I sometimes wonder that if we, like, what impact outside influences have on a game. So if you, I've meant to be covering one game before and I've covered another, and I just thought I would have loved to have been at that game. Would it have been the same if I was there? Well, of course it would have been the same if I was there. I'm up on a gantry. They can't see you. So
you're not that
the logic of superstitions, the logic of superstitions is pretty stupid.
I once wore a bright shirt to a press conference, though, because I wanted a new manager to notice me, which is a true story. It was Alan Perrin. And ever since then, I've had this thing afterwards that whenever I meet a new boss, a new manager, a new group of people, or start a new TV show, I wear something that makes me stand out, just to ensure that even if people start asking, who is this bloke? Why is he wearing that stupid orange shirt? That they'll find out, or at best remember who I am.
So you wouldn't wear a grey jumper, for example? So Michelle would be struggling today.
Enough on the grey jumper.
I wouldn't be wearing a grey jumper.
You are right about superstitions, though. And I remember back in 1999, the Champions League final, United were losing, of course, to Bayern Munich. And I changed my socks with about 20 minutes left. And they went on a 1-2-1.
No.
All down to me.
All down to you.
Nothing to do with Sheringham or Solskjaer or Fergie. All down to me changing my socks.
Actually, do you know what? I've just realised in the World Cup, I didn't wear my England shirt at all because I was convinced when I wore my England shirt, every tournament I wore it in, we'd done rubbish. And so we got to the semi-final. I was like, well, should I wear it? And chose not to wear it. Just sort of had it in my lap. And it made not a blind bit of difference. So there we are. We still lost.
We all have superstitions. It's a football thing, isn't it? I mean, Eddie Howe, for example, I remember he held his first ever 9 a.m. press conference before Bournemouth beat Chelsea at Stamford Bridge. Sorry, Sam. Glenn Murray got the goal. He's been doing that ever since. And he also refuses, Eddie, to park in his designated parking space at the ground because he wants to use the same space as when they went up from the Championship into the Premier League. He is very superstitious.
He is very superstitious.
Yeah, Eddie. Warnock's the same. Warnock had his presser at the Cardiff City Stadium when they won those two games back to back. And now we're back in the hotel because they started losing again.
So he chooses the venue of his press conference on whether or not they win the next game.
Yeah, so needless to say, we've hardly been in the stadium this season.
Oh my God, an insane goal!
The language of love. Our favourite words in the football lexicon.
So earlier on, I asked you where you thought the phrase Route 1 had come from. We mentioned Wimbledon. We mentioned a couple of other teams in the Premier League. And Michelle, you started talking about maps. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's what. Maps and directions, sort of Route 1. You know, like when you get, I know it wasn't around at the time, but Google Maps, and it tells you which is the best way to go. That's
so when it came out,
on
this phrase for Wimbledon in the 80s, do you think it was to do with Google Maps?
No, the AA maps, the ones the Atlas used to have in the
Ordnance
back of your car.
Survey, I think they're officially titled, aren't they?
And Crook, you were more interested in
transport, buses, trains.
Okay. Well, the phrase actually has been ascribed to the 1970s television programme Quizball. Now, none of us are old enough to remember this, not even me, Michelle, before you start, where footballers who fancied their general knowledge went on the show and answered sort of questions about what was happening in politics and sort of like history, etc., etc., etc. And you could score either by answering one hard question, which was Route 1, or by putting together a series of answer in easier questions, Route 4, that never caught on, in order to move up the board. So this popular TV show coined the phrase Route 1, and then it was adopted by football as a result of that.
You would think it was something to do with directions though, wouldn't you? Like direct, being direct, but there we are.
Interestingly, it's not the only time that a TV show has spawned a phrase which has then moved into football. Because playing catch-up, which is pretty popular now to describe a team that is chasing a particular game or pursuing the league leaders in the title run-in, is a phrase that sounds like it's like you come out of America or something like that. But actually, do you know where it came from?
No.
A TV show called Going for Gold. Do you remember that with Henry Kelly?
No, we're far too young, Sam.
Oh, come on. You definitely remember Going for Gold. Even had a theme tune. It was definitely sort of like mid-90s sort of time. If you were off school sick, you'd always see Going for Gold.
1987, the first ever episode. I was five.
Yeah, that was the first ever episode. Well, first ever episode of Coronation Street was 1960-something. You still watch that.
Oh, I love a bit of Corrie. Me and Jane Danson, best mate.
The last episode was broadcast in 1996. So how old were you then, Crook?
I was 14. But
14, see, perfect. You were skipping school around that time. You must have seen Henry Kelly. It was brilliant. You used to go around all the European countries, and every time you buzzed in, you had to say the name of your country. So you'd have someone from Austria, and then someone from Sweden, and then Germany. And it was like, it was brilliant. You got to see all these different accents from different places.
Sounds amazing. I'm genuinely gutted that I missed it.
Yeah, well, maybe we could bring it back. That could be our next project.
Okay, I still have no idea what you're talking about because I was six. Next, what happened when I had a breakfast time chat with TalkSport commentator Jim Proudfoot.
It's all over, I think. No.
Subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts and all major podcast platforms. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
So it was very odd being at a midday kickoff, Watford against Leicester, Brendan Rodgers' first game in charge. You know, it's always early when you're at a ground and they're serving breakfast rather than lunch or dinner. So Jim Proudfoot tucked away our breakfasts and then we had a little chat all about how he got into commentating and some of his most famous moments, including England against Colombia in the World Cup finals.
The question we ask everyone is how do you get into this weird line of work?
I went to university, realised after about 6 weeks that I wasn't going to get the economics degree that I'd signed up for. and instead of doing what normal, sensible people would have done, which would be to transfer to a course that was more something that I could get my head around, I got involved in student radio. So having done student radio for, I don't know, even probably 4 or 5 weeks, I knew that that was what I wanted to do for a living. In some way, I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I started by doing some sports reporting. And back in those days, so this was early 90s, Club Call was at the fore, which people don't remember Club Call. It was in the days pre-internet.
Right.
It was an 0898 number you could phone and pay 50 pence a minute to get the latest sports news and commentaries and reports on games.
Yeah.
Obviously, you would always try and draw out, knowing that you were paying 50 pence a minute, people were paying 50 pence a minute, you'd keep the stories for, you know, sort of 3-4 minutes in.
Oh, what a businessman. So, see, the economics degree isn't completely wasted.
But that gave me the opportunity to commentate on lower league football to a very small audience.
Did people tune in for a whole game?
Depending on the club. So I was based down in the southwest, so most Plymouth games were commentary. They were Championship at the time.
Is that where you're from?
Originally, well, I'm a southwest boy, but was brought up in Birmingham. Yeah. So I don't remember living in the southwest before I moved. But yeah, Torquay's my team and consider myself a West Country boy, really.
So how did you go from doing the Club Call stuff?
I think with a lot of people, just being in the right place at the right time and having enormous slices of luck that didn't appreciate really how lucky I was being at the time. You just sort of go with the flow and you're, here's an opportunity. Oh, can you come and do this? Can you come and do that? And you do it. And then so I ended up working in local radio. And I was working for the local station, was a station called Devon Air, who had no money. And the sports editor, who had got me in, I was a friend of his, he started working up in London, working for Capital. So at the weekends, they had nobody to do the sport. So they employed three teenagers. Russell Fuller, who's now the tennis correspondent for Five Live, he was the presenter. And we had two reporters, me and Jonathan Wall, who's the boss of Five Live.
Yeah.
So it was
amazing.
the three of us, all teenagers. If we got £100 a week between the three of us, I'd be surprised. We probably didn't quite, but it was a fantastic grounding. And it was then, having done that for about 18 months, other opportunities came along. I went to, having left university, I went to journalism college, trained as a news journalist. And then John Murray took me on up in Middlesbrough. So I worked with John. Obviously, he was doing the football. I did a little bit of football with him. And then went down to London and worked, got a job at Capital. But again, that was just happened to be that somebody up in the northeast heard that they needed a reporter and put a good word in for me. So by the time I was 21, I'd probably had a career's worth of good luck. And, you know, I've been very fortunate since, but I had so many lucky breaks when I started.
Yeah, but you say that, but you've got an amazing voice, and obviously you've worked very, very hard. How did you make the switch from, was it Sky to Setanta?
Yeah, I was only ever a freelancer at Sky, and they've been great to me, they've given me some great opportunities, but after being there 6 or 7 years, there was no sign of a full-time job. An opportunity came up, a producer called Colin Davidson, who I'd worked with at Sky, went up to Setanta. They bought a lot of European rights and they had some Premier League football. And he asked me one night to if I would be prepared to go up and work up there, commute up. So I would go up or fly up on a Friday or a Saturday, 2 days up there, and come back down. But it was a full-time job. And it was a calculated risk, really. If I'd stayed at Sky, I wasn't going to get Premier League football. Rightly, wasn't going to get Premier League football. That sounds like a complaint. Not at all. But, you know, I have my place in the pecking order at Sky. Fewer commentators at Setanta. It was a good opportunity, to use a footballing analogy, maybe to move down a division, but to be guaranteed first team football and then hopefully to help Setanta build. Now, as it turns out, it didn't happen that way, but I was able to do some Premier League games on Setanta, 20 maybe over the course of 3 years. I would never have got that at Sky.
No.
So it didn't work out with Setanta, obviously. The company went into administration, owed us all a lot of money when they went bust, and created a lot of bitterness amongst a lot of people. But I don't ever regret going, because it gave me the opportunities that I wouldn't have had, and I really enjoyed working in Glasgow, working in Scotland, met some fantastic people. And then I was fortunate that because I was based down south, when ESPN then started, I was in the right position. I was an hour from the office, and so I was able to, much as I lost a lot of money I've been owed in terms of wages, I wasn't out of work. So I was able to sort of pick it up sort of more easily and continue, and got a contract there.
Yeah, absolutely incredible sort of when you look back on what happened to Setanta. But, you know, you look where you are now, and it's sort of, it's weird how things all just lead to where they lead, don't they? And you have the Premier League productions today, you obviously do a lot for TalkSport. Talk to me about England against Colombia in the World Cup. Talk to me about those moments.
Well, commentating on England is a unique thing, because as I say, I support Torquay. I probably commentated on Torquay a couple of times, only a couple of times in my career. And it's relatively easy to be dispassionate about commentating on a league game, even if it's the team that you support. When you're commentating on England, it's different, because you have that emotional investment in what is in what is happening in front of you. And so it's in many ways, it's much harder. I don't know that I enjoy commentating on England at the time as much as I do some other games, because of the nervousness.
The emotional attachment.
Absolutely that. So it's it always probably on edge. I'm not a great person to be around, I don't think, on the day of an England game. Really enjoy looking back on it and, you know, what England have done. But those are the ones where I really sort of, that there is inevitably a different approach, because the vast majority of people that you are broadcasting to all want that same result.
You can be biased, can't you?
You can. Well, you can be biased to a certain extent. I think you've still got to be fair. I don't think you can pull the wool over people's eyes.
Yeah, you can't. Not saying England deserves something when they don't, no. But in terms of the passion, you can't hide your passion.
No, you can't hide your passion, and I wasn't able to hide my passion for that game against Colombia. Inevitably, there is a selfishness about it. You're watching that, you're thinking, well, hang on, I've got the chance here to commentate on England in a World Cup quarter final if you win this shootout. So it's not just England getting there, it's me having the chance to do a game of that magnitude. And that certainly was going through my mind in the semi-finals. I would be lying. You know, Kieran Trippier puts his free kick in, and I'm sitting there thinking, you know, on Sunday, I could be one of a very select band of Englishmen who've ever commentated on their country in a World Cup final. And, you know, what a privilege that would have been. So the Colombia game, having commentated on England on and off for the space of about 15 years, I suppose, I've seen a lot of penalty shootouts go the wrong way. So
it was a bit, everyone expected England not to win that shootout, didn't they? What were your thoughts going into it? What were you thinking? Did you think this was a different mentality this time round?
I did think that there was a different mentality, and I would back Jordan Pickford in a penalty shootout against the vast majority of goalkeepers in that tournament. So it's probably slightly more confidence than normal, but everything's relative, because the manner in which the game had transpired, England ahead, pegged back as late as they were, extra time, England for the first 15-20 minutes of extra time were hopeless. And so you kind of thought, well, this, it could all happen again. It could be another disappointing elimination against a country that England would feel, would have felt beforehand that they shouldn't lose to. So then when it goes to the penalty shootout and, you know, things start to go England's way, that there is that natural excitement. And, you know, when Eric Dier stepped forward, who hadn't been at his best after coming off the bench, I did think, no, well, I can't believe that this is going to happen. But he proved me wrong, and it was a wonderful night. I'll never forget that. It was just a brilliant time. It was one of the best games I've ever commentated on. Simply for the, you know, for the emotional release and what it meant for England and what it meant for it was obvious because of that emotional attachment. You can easily relate to what it means for the people, for my sons as England fans listening. You know what it meant to everybody that they'd actually won.
And the semi-final was just so disappointing, wasn't it? Any tears in the eyes on that one?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'm not ashamed to say, there was from a selfish perspective as well as from a footballing perspective, because that might well be the only opportunity I get. I mean, this business is cyclical. Don't know what's going to be happening 2 or 4 years' time. And I think that probably, you know, as we sit here now, if I was to say I would commentate on England in a World Cup final, it could happen. But, you know, I may never commentate on a World Cup final again, let alone one that England are in. You can't take anything for granted. So there were definite tears in the eyes, and walking away from the stadium knowing we'd be making the same walk 3 days later for a game that England weren't in. Yeah, of course it was emotional because everyone's got so much invested in it. But I am actually pretty confident that England will now win a major trophy in my lifetime. I couldn't have said that 2-3 years ago. But I think that I can envisage circumstances now in which it would happen. That helps, that England have got this seemingly, this sense of timing that it's all coming good when some of the others aren't particularly great. So you never know. But the next World Cup final's on the day before my 50th birthday. So I think that everything's written. It's all scripted.
Finally, there's a lot of people that listen to our podcast that are keen to get into broadcasting. A lot of them want to be commentators like yourself. What would you say is like a number one, I don't know, tip for people trying to get into it? I know you've said luck, but obviously there's a lot of hard work, and you're being hard on yourself when you say you don't do half of that.
I think the most important thing you have to do, I look back at when I started, and I was phenomenally lucky, but I had a very naive approach to it, that it never occurred to me that I wouldn't be able to make it. And it's only now, sort of 25 years on, that I certainly haven't got that attitude anymore. But I think that certainly helped me. That helped me a lot. The persistence, never giving up. I actually think it's much, much harder now for people to break in than it was a generation ago when I did it. And I think that has been borne out really by the fact that there aren't many people in their 20s or early 30s who do it in the mainstream media anymore. Because I just think it's so much harder. When I started, there was a real route map, what you did. So it was local radio. Every club in the country would have 2 or 3
local radio stations who were reporting on the team or commentating on the team, and the independent radio network that I came through just doesn't exist in the same way anymore. And so it is harder. I know that there's a proliferation of social media, and that in many ways will make it easier for people to get their stuff seen. But I think getting the opportunities on air is so much harder than it ever was before. And I think that if I'd been 25 years younger, I really don't know that I would have been able to earn a living out of it. So I think offering people advice is difficult now because I can't draw on my own experience, other than saying that in 20 years' time there will still be a need for football commentators, so it might as well be you. You make sure that you go out and do it and have the belief in yourself that you can succeed, whether you want to succeed in doing this or report or whatever it is that you end up doing, something completely different. You just have to have the belief that you will be able to make it. I think that's the most important thing. You do need a lot of luck, and as I say, I've been blessed with more than my fair share over the years. But have the persistence, probably have a plan B as well, a fallback position, and consider going into the football side of it as well as the broadcasting side, I think can be a good way in these days where press offices, multi-staff now. They didn't used to be when I started. Certainly in lower league clubs, you would have, you know, the commercial manager might do a little bit, and then the reporters kind of sort of, the local guys would all sort it out themselves. Nowadays, every club has a media department, the vast majority of whom are fantastic. They do lots of social media, commentary on youth games, whatever. But get as much experience as you can. If you want to commentate, get as much experience. Be prepared that it's going to be for next to no money, or indeed no money. But the more miles you can get on the clock, the better it will make you. And if you can make your mistakes like I did on matches where no one is listening to you, probably literally no one in some cases, that can only be beneficial. But just have the confidence and believe in yourself.
Yeah, it was great to catch up with Jim. Much like Liverpool's title hopes, that was written by Crook. I'm afraid we have come to the end of another podcast. It's not my words. This is what's been put in front of me. I know, I don't agree. Do join us again next week when my Sky Sports colleague, Julia Warren, Jules from a Soccer Special, will be our guest geek.
Can I just ask, before we go, Crook, will you be in a studio or somewhere where we can hear you without the noises of an industrial cleaner in the background next week?
Well, we're struggling to find time next week, aren't we? Because I'm on a jolly at Cheltenham Races on Tuesday. You're on a jolly at Cheltenham Races on Wednesday. So I think Monday evening. So I should be at home on Monday evening. There shouldn't be any hoovers.
The jollies. On Monday, I'm also on the EFL judging panel for players of the season and teams of the season, etc., etc.
Oh, wait. Did you hear that? That's a big bang when you just drop that in there, Sam.
Well, that was the cleaner. She's gone now. Would you believe it? She's gone now.
Yeah, I can believe it, funnily enough. All right, have a good rest of the week, and we'll see you next Monday. Oh, my God. Just get us out of here.
Barney's saying goodbye.
Bye, guys.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over.
The only people you know that can legitimately buy a pair of binoculars. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.